The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the last edition of The Heretics Hour for the year 2013. It is December 30th, and I'm your host, Carolyn Yeager. I'm kind of sorry to see this year end. It has been a very good year for my own work and my websites. And, you know, today I just learned that the White Network has been recognized in a survey of 35 pro-white websites. According to Alexa rankings, we are number 23 in this particular selection of 35 sites. It's a person named Russell who has been experienced in the pro-white movement for a while, and he just decided to make a new list at this time of the year. And he picked out 35 what he considered pro-white websites. And he made a pretty good choice, although naturally I consider he left some things out. He didn't put my CarolynYeager.net in there. He probably is not that aware of it, but it certainly has a higher ranking than I would have been listed in a pretty good position on his list if he had. But that's be that as it may, he did include the White Network, and we came up at number 23 out of 35, which is pretty good because we don't have much here but our radio programs and comment boards. You know, it's not like we write lots of articles that people would come to read, or we post articles of others. We don't, and we don't keep up with current news or post news items like so many do. And we don't even have a lot of radio hosts. You know, this is a very small operation. But our Alexa Global ranking is standing at around 379,000 right now. And that's considered quite good, considering the number of websites. I think it was 800 and some million or something globally. Although this is just amongst the white what they call pro-white, because they're not all white nationalists at all. And some of them I wouldn't even say were that pro-white. But as I said, that was this person's list. And, of course, what came in first? Stormfront was first. And we, the White Network, were, as I recall, between Majority Rights was ahead of us and VNN was right behind us. That's Vanguard News Network. Of course, Vanguard News Forum was Vanguard News Network Forum was further ahead than that. It was had a higher ranking, but just VNN itself. So that's pretty darn good, because especially I think it's amazing because we won't be celebrating our second birthday until next June. So we're about a year and a half old now. And I want to thank all of you who come and check our site every day. Some people probably do see what we have here. We're very happy. Of course, I know that people download our programs, but that people visit our site so much is also very rewarding. I got a letter today from Roger in the mail. I should say we got a letter in our post office box, and there was a check for $20 in it, and he's wrote to me that he enjoys my shows because I expose the holo-hoax and explain real history. He says he plans to become a regular supporter when his financial fortunes look up after this summer. That's what he expects. And so I really appreciate hearing from Roger, and I know that he will be happy to hear that those two topics that he likes, Holo Hoax and Real History, are at the top of my own plan for 2014. That actually just settled down very comfortably in my mind today when I realized that's where I was going. I knew I was going to have some direction. I knew it was a Holocaust, but the other two, I feel I'm very much motivated now to take on all these lies that I hear, and I call them lies because I think it's not always, sometimes people just don't know. But there's a lot of BS floating around in the area that I care about, which is Hitler and World War II, Third Reich, National Socialism. It just doesn't end. You know, you can clear up something and then there's more of it comes up. And I'm not going to be able to end it. I know that. But at least I have decided I want to be on record about as much of it as possible. And that's what I'm going to be concentrating on this year, which makes me very happy because it's what I want to do. It's what I would like to do. And I'll let other, not that I won't get into something else when things come up, but that's the way I see 2014 lining up. And I do tend to be a person who takes the new year seriously. I just like it. It's a really good time to say, well, what's going to happen next? What happened? How did I do last year? Or what went on and what's going to come up next? And I always do have some clear idea what it is I want to accomplish. I don't know if I always accomplish it. I got a bunch of pages of my New Year's resolutions for quite a few years going back. And when I go back and look at them, I'm like, well, I didn't do too well with that. But anyway, it was a pretty good year anyway. So I don't know how I'll do with this, but it seems to be jiving for me. And I was going to say about the BS, you know, I know people just accept things too easily. And I think there's too much information coming and going. And so it becomes confusing. And they think that they've got it when they've got just a little bit. And then it gets kind of mixed up. But there's also liars, you know, I probably mentioned that too early, a few sentences back, but there are also liars, and I truly hate lies, and I hate liars, therefore, because they're the ones who tell the lies. And so I do expect to be exposing a lot of lies and also a lot of liars this coming year, but also people who are, as what we call, misinforming others. Now, I want to also thank Dimitar at this time, who is a very regular contributor to the White Neck Network, and I just got his contribution for this month, or probably for January, but today. And I want to thank him. We do appreciate our regular contributors so much. Here's this website. Well, I link to it here. So I can tell you it's called theforemostproblem.blogspot.ca. And it's 2013-12, the 35 most popular pro-white websites. So his name is Russell. You can go there and look at his website and see the list that he's got there. Theforemostproblem.blogspot.ca. Or the 35 most popular pro-white websites. Okay, I want to comment, you know, there's been a lot of, I've had a lot on this program and my Saturday program too about Mark Weber in the last month, maybe longer, but mostly in the last month. And that will be continuing, since I'm going to be continuing to talk about these issues. And we got in on our comment board to one of these programs. Greg Gerdes has been writing some comments, and he got brought up David Irving and the 2.4 million Jews, and he sent me this link to The Guardian. And I want to cover that here because, you know, we've been talking about Mark Weber taking his information from David Irving about the gas chambers in the Sobibor, Belzec, and Treblinka transit camps that are called now, started being called extermination camps, when there's no evidence there whatsoever of any kind of gas chambers or any chambers or any murders going on or whatever. But that's been talked about quite a bit, and it will be talked about more. But what David Irving did say, and this was all the way back in 2007, to an interviewer from the Guardian newspaper in the United Kingdom. And this article goes that this interviewer was there at his home having tea with him, and he says that Mr. Irving says that his views on the Holocaust have crystallized rather than changed. That is, this is after he was released from prison in Austria, and he underwent some kind of shock, I guess, or something, and he started saying a lot of things and was quoted as saying some kind of surprising things that didn't do very well for his reputation. And then he started working on some new ideas about what he believed about Holocaust. And he says that the interviewer said that he believes that Jews were responsible for what happened to them during the Second World War, and that the Jewish problem was responsible for nearly all the wars of the past 100 years. That's not a quote, but this is a quote. The Jews are the architects of their own misfortune, but that is the short version, A to Z, between A and Z, there are 24 other characters in intervening steps. Well, that's a kind of a, you know, coy way that Irving is talking about things without, you know, intimating things without actually saying them, saying it, because you, of course, you do have to be careful what you actually say. But going on, the interviewer says that Irving still insists he's a respected academic. He's trying to get his career back on track. He says that a document which he is 80% sure is genuine, which is the Herfle telegram, which is not mentioned by name here, but that's what it is, suggests, he says, and there he uses that word, you see, suggests, that 2.4 million Jews were killed in Poland. But Irving goes on to claim that the gas chamber at Auschwitz was fake. Okay, now here's a quote from Irving. It was not the center of the killing operations. It has only become a focus because it is the site that is best preserved. Much of what is shown to tourists there is faked post-war watchtowers, even the famous gas chamber. Well, all right, that fits the facts. So, but now here he adds, and here's another quote. And remember, this was in 2007, he said this. In my opinion now, the real killing operations took place at the Reinhardt camps west of the Bug River. In the three camps here, which again is, he means Sobibor, Belzec, Treblinka, Heinrich Himmler's men, and in parentheses, this is supposed to be a quote, but it's put in parentheses, mostly Ukrainian mercenaries. He may have put this in writing for the interviewer. Who knows? I don't know. But he says that the real killing operations took place at these Reinhardt camps. In there, Heinrich Himmler's men, mostly Ukrainian mercenaries. These were Heinrich Himmler's men, were Ukrainian mercenaries? I have a question that. Killed possibly as many as 2.4 million in the 2 years up to October 1943. So 2 years, October 41 to October 43, that's what he is saying here. And this quote continues from Irving. There is now nothing to be seen of the Reinhardt camps, neither stick nor stone, so few tourists go there. I have visited all four sites earlier this year. Well, big, you know, big deal, I'll say to him, because he admits there's nothing to be seen, so he can make these claims. He's making these claims while at the same time saying, well, I can't prove it because there's nothing there. And most tourists don't go there, so he thinks he's, I guess, you know, people who we think are very, very intelligent. And they have to be very intelligent, but they, all people have their feet of clay, you might say. I don't know if that's the proper phrase, but, you know, their dumb side, where their blind side, where they are, they're blind because they can't deal with it, because they don't want to look at it, because they're trying to put something across, you know. And Irving is this type. He thinks he can put something across on people. He thinks he's got such influence and power when he speaks that people, you know, believe what he says and are listening to him, that then he can put this out there, and at the same time, he can just ignore this part that doesn't quite, he doesn't know how, you know, he can ignore some other part of it, and nobody will ask any questions because they don't know enough about it. Nobody goes there. Nobody cares. And so it's like people say he's doing this to get the Jews off his back, although they don't get off his back, or to get the historians off his back, because he's now admitting that Jews were killed, which is what the historians want, you know, what the narrative is. But he's blaming Himmler and some Ukrainian mercenaries, and he's putting it in these camps that nobody goes to and where there's nothing left and so on. You see how he's working this whole thing out. What it does is it just makes me not have much respect for David Irving, which I haven't for quite a while now. And it's too bad because he's done such brilliant work, but he's also got real problems with honesty and telling the truth and trying to make a good story and so on. So he then says, you know, he was pressed by the interviewer, I guess, as to whether this change undermined his previous stance. And his reply was, it is a crystallization of my view. Well, it's hardly a crystallization of his previous view, where he never said anything about these Reinhardt camps. But he came to the conclusion that there was no gassings at all because there was no gassings at Auschwitz. And then after his imprisonment and some time of thinking about it, he crystallized his thinking into saying, well, I guess there was gassings, but they were in those camps that nobody can see and nobody knows about and nobody knows much about either. So here's another quote from Irving. I do accept that the Nazis quite definitely, that Heinrich Himmler organized and directed a program, a clandestine program, for the liquidation of European Jews. And that in 1942-43 alone, over 2.5 million Jews, now he's got it over, not 2.4, but over 2.5 million Jews were killed in those three camps. He added that Hitler was, quote, completely in the dark, unquote, about the program. Pretty ridiculous. Well, that's what Mark Weber is following, and that's why he's so uncomfortable when he's called upon to answer these questions, and he starts stammering and saying these things, you know, oh, 1 million, then another time it was 2 million. Well, I think over 2 million, at least 2 million were killed in these camps, and he has no evidence. Mark Weber has no reason to say it or believe it. He's only copying or following David Irving. So this is just another example of why we need to get these things straight, why we need to keep working on it, why Holocaust revisionism is very important, and also Holocaust denial, if you want to call it denial, must continue to be a top priority for Germans and those who are of German ancestry, of at least of one half or more, are I consider German and have some interest in this. For example, I'm going to give some examples now of why it's so important to overcome the this rubbish that is still floating around out there all the time. Now, this morning, I received a page from something called the London Regional Press Office. It's a website. It's a blog or something. It's a part of the British National Party, and there's a person there named, now, what did I not put his name down here, I guess. Well, he's got Hohenstaufen, he calls himself. I'm going to have to go to that, let's see. I should go to, okay, here I am. I should go to that Skype message, if I can find it. Now, where did it go? Gee, on this way down on this list, why don't I'm at recent. Recent. But he's not here. Well, oh, here, I'm not at recent. Okay, here we go. Here we go. He says, my correspondent actually is Paul Hickman. He sent this to me. You know, he keeps up with everything in Britain with the parties and so on. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, he sent me the page, and he said it's by the London BNP mayoral 2012 candidate, Carlos Cortiglia, who likes Jews, and he's argued with him before. But he's noticed that there's an article written by a new contributor on this blog whose name is Carl Gerhard Hohenstaufen. And there's a person pictured at the top of the blog. You know, it's a regular blog design, top of the page of this London regional office website. And he's kind of a goofy looking guy with light colored hair, and he's smiling, and it says that he's Carl Gerhard Hohenstaufen. But Paul says that he checked on Facebook, and it's actually Carlos, this guy named Carlos Cortiglia. And then, so I guess that's enough that for that. Let me go back to the White Network. Oh, look how I did that right away. Good for me. And go back to my page. All right, so now... this blog post by this Carl Gerhard, or this Gerhard Hohenstaufen, is titled, here it is right here, the London, here's the link, the London Regional Press Office .blogspot.co.uk. What did Goebbels, Eichmann, and Mengele have in common? Dark eyes, dark hair, and dark complexion. That's what he's writing about here. That he takes these three National Socialists, who everybody's familiar with their names, and says that they all had dark eyes, dark hair, and dark complexion. And he says what it means. He says that this refers to what it means to be German, the typical description of tall, light-skinned, and light-eyed individuals with a propensity for violence, which is depicted in the mass media, has been a fabrication no less than the dreams of an Aryan race. What is even more ridiculous, he writes, is that some key players in the construction of the Reich that was going to last 1,000 years. See, now that's a sarcastic remark, making fun, sarcasm toward the Reich that was supposed to last 1,000 years and, of course, did not, were themselves, he says, far different from the images that the propaganda makers made. I don't agree with that. It was not true that the Reich was trying to promote themselves as a bunch of tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, strong Aryans. They didn't do that at all. They never did that, but that's what the propaganda tells us. So he has a picture here of Goebbels. He has a picture of Adolf Eichmann, which is kind of dark. He's kind of in the shadows, and he's got these heavy glasses on. You can't see, you can hardly see his eyes, and you can't tell at all what color they are. So but you can see he doesn't have dark hair, but even so, it's a little dark because of the lighting. But actually, Adolf Eichmann had light colored hair and light eyes. And if you look at a good picture of him, which you can find, I found one just right away on Wikipedia, his official portrait in his uniform and hat, where he's very clearly, his eyes are quite light. So that's a lie. And then he has a picture of Joseph Mengele, where, it's in shadow and some light on the forehead, outdoors, in kind of a sunlight. And he's squinting, and his eyes are all, in darkness. And you can't see. And Mengele didn't have dark complexion. None of these men had a dark complexion. But Goebbels and Mengele had dark hair. Mengele's probably not as dark as Goebbels. And Goebbels did have brown eyes. I don't know about Mengele. He may have had brown eyes. He may have had blue eyes. But, you know, all these things that he is saying here are just not true. So this is just the way that they present this, why he's presenting this, why the BNP is presenting this. It's hard to say. But it goes, it even says here, which is what bothered Paul Hickman, was that it said about Joseph Mengele that he carried out experiments injecting blue dyes into the eyes of children to see if eye color could be changed by other means rather than inheritance. What rubbish. What rubbish. Of course you can't inject dye into anybody's eyes. And Joseph Mengele never did any such thing. And they had no intention to try to change children or anybody's eye color to make their change their eyes from dark to light or something. Why would they even do that? It's so insane. And yet, friends, I bring this up because people will read this, even people who should know better, and they'll believe it because it looks like somebody they trust, the BNP, is telling them this. So especially British people will believe it. And maybe American people will some of them will believe some of it. And this whole thing about Mengele and his experiments with children and inject and trying to change their eye color has been so pervasive that it's hard to stamp it out. Of course, it's insanity, really. And then they write about Adolf Eichmann, that he was harassed as a school child. Not they, this person here is writing this, saying that Adolf Eichmann was harassed as a school child because he didn't look the part of what people expected him to be. That's rubbish, too. I want to call it BS, but I'm using the word rubbish. It's more acceptable. Saying he used to be chased around the classroom by fellow pupils that called him Jude. You know, they don't know that. That there's no source for any of this. Just made up stuff. Eichmann was not Jewish, and nobody thought he was Jewish except after, you know, after the war, there's all this talk about him being Jewish. So the purpose of Carlos, who's being called Herr Hofenstaufen now, is that he says those who try and build political ideologies based on racial characteristics are very far off the mark and bound to make the same mistaken assumptions made many decades ago. He's saying that, you know, the Third Reich was based on mistaken assumptions about building your political ideology on race, and saying that that's a big mistake. And then he goes on to say, to justify this blog, for those of us who honestly want to protect British identity, okay, that's what BNP says it's trying to do. Shared ideas and shared principles are what matters most in terms of a national identity. Shared ideas and shared principles. That's what we're supposed to have here in the United States, too. Multiculturalism, he writes, is divisive. Now, that's true. But so he said that, and then he goes on and says, it's discriminatory. It has nothing to do with building communities that can live in peace. That's true. Then he says, though, what we see today in Britain is a construction of ghettos leading to a cycle of suspicion, fear, and confrontation in a country being colonized with flood immigration. So, you know, the message that he's sending us here is very mixed. It's totally mixed, the way I see it. He starts out with a very anti-racial message. And then at the end tries to cloak this message in anti-multiculturalism. And also they show off quite a bit of anti-Nazism and anti-Germanism, which is something typical in Britain And something that British parties would think would go over good with the British people. So I see a lot of subversive qualities going on here, or mixed messages, more like a mix, you know. And you something like this you have to look at closely and see what's actually taking place here, and it reflects badly on those who are putting it out. And in this case, it seems to be the British National Party. So now I want to move on, because I don't hardly have enough time in this first hour, which is all I have for it, typical of me, to do what I really want to, this other thing, which is to read to you, read to you the preface to T.S. Christofferson's pamphlet, Die Auschwitz Lüge, which is the Auschwitz lie. I'm working on, I don't want to make it just me, because there's a committee. It's called the January 27th Committee, and I have help, and there are people. We're working on this website, and I'm kind of in charge, and I'm also going to be the treasurer. I'm the treasurer, folks, of this January 27th. .org committee. So I'll get in here real quick. I keep talking about money, but this time of year is when everybody's sending out their donation pleas and their contribution pleas big time, because this just seems to be the time of year and people are ready to give more. So I guess I should be doing it now. Say again that I there are some extra expenses. I will say that I have I purchased a server. What's it called? I can't think of it now. A single server, a small one for this site, because I didn't want to put it. I didn't think it should be put on a other website, anybody else's website, nobody's, because it could be attacked quite virulently, and then it would affect these other websites. So. It's on its own server, and this costs some money, and it's going to be a monthly charge, and there are expenses involved here. So anybody who wants to send anything for this particular project, it's going to go into my PayPal. I'm going to have to receive it there, because I don't want to set up another account for October 27th. So you just go to the PayPal, CarolynJaeger.com, and mark it for January 27th. Thank you very much. And I will be sure, I'm a very honest person, and I'll be sure that that's where it goes. So one of the things that I have never read before, didn't know that it was available or something, just didn't come up for me, was T.S. Christofferson's Die Auschwitz Lüge, the Auschwitz lie. I'm mentioning, I looked for it, and Grandma Rudolph actually showed me that it was already in English on the internet and showed me where it was. And so I'm including that. I'm not including the preface, because I don't want to put too much, I have just tons and tons and tons of stuff to read, and people won't read any of it then. I think the preface to this, to Christofferson's pamphlet is just excellent. And it's written by Manfred Roeder, who was a military judge in National Socialist Germany. He was born in 1900. He died in October 1971. And this pamphlet came out like in 72, 71 maybe. Or 72, but not in English. It didn't come out until a little bit later. It wasn't available in English until a little bit later. So it was right towards the end of his life that this came out. I don't know exactly when he wrote it. He probably wrote it maybe a year or two before that. But he was involved in the investigation, examination, and prosecutions of the Red Orchestra spy ring, which some of you will be familiar with. And anyway, it was a big, highly organized spy ring in Germany, which included a lot of Germans and some non-Germans, and is basically sourced in Soviet Union. It was communist. And they did get do a whole lot of damage before they were finally uncovered and prosecuted. And it really was put out of business. And he was involved in that. He was known as a hard and loyal judge. That means he was a loyal National Socialist. So he writes in this preface to Christofferson's pamphlet. And Christofferson wrote about his experience actually working at Auschwitz for a year. And that's what his thing is about. And it's you know, he says that nothing like is said ever happened. Not only not gas chambers, but not brutality and not any of the terrible treatment of the people there or any of it. He would have seen it. And he sounds like a very honest man. Of course, naturally, I think he's honest. But so Rauter says, and I'm quoting now from what he wrote, "For God's sake," he's quoting people talking to him, "for God's sake, can't you carry on with your fight against pornography and moral degeneration without getting tied up in politics? Why are you so concerned about the past? Surely you don't want to justify National Socialism or deny the crimes of the past." Rauter says, "Even very good friends made such imploring appeals to me after I had mentioned the word Auschwitz in connection with horror propaganda for the first time. An honestly concerned priest wrote to me, 'I have to tell you that your turning to political right-wing radicalism has frightened me a little, but I will stand behind you also in future because I know you.'" Now, remember, this would have been probably in the late 60s. So he goes on writing, "As pleased as I was about the confidence of this priest," he says, "it was alarming to realize how every effort to find truth and justice for Germany is termed political right-wing radicalism. Yes, how much I would like to let the past rest. If there was a mutual promise from all sides to forgive and forget, as it was done in the peace treaty after the 30 Years' War in 1648, nothing was to be touched upon after that peace treaty was formed, you know. No persecutions were to be held. This was indeed a heroic achievement of dignity in the spirit of Christ." Let me tell you, I think that Rauter was a practicing Christian and maybe a Catholic, but I can't say for sure. I couldn't find out for sure, but he does mention this priest friend. "What do we see today?" he asks. "Who is willing to forgive, to forget, and heal old wounds? Only the Germans, and especially German refugees, have offered their intentions again and again, supported by deeds. What does the other side do? You know, it's true that these refugees, the ones who were driven out, of, who survived being driven out of the eastern, their eastern homelands, and came into this much smaller Germany, crowded as refugees, were the ones who later worked to send aid packages and food and all kinds of things to countries like Poland, the Czech, whatever the Czech was called at that time, Czechoslovakia maybe, and after the war, what was it called? I don't know. And those other countries who were under communism, they had great sympathy for these people because they used to live there. And they still considered, in a sense, you know, that that was their homeland. That was their where they had lived for so many generations. And they did a whole lot for these people. And then when the communist wall came down and everything, you know, changed, these people were still totally hateful toward them, you know, and didn't appreciate what they had done at all and weren't given any credit for it. But anyway, that's my understanding at this point. Let me go on. "The government of the German Reich," he writes, "was illegally removed from office. German officers who had done nothing but their duty and whose characters were far superior to those of the Allies passing judgment on them, were sadistically strangled, while no single soldier or partisan of the enemy was brought into court for war crimes. German, you know, and that's, think about that. Only the Germans, the Japanese, and Italians maybe or something could be convicted of war crimes. Could you even form a court to bring them to trial for anything? Nobody else. It was not allowed. And no partisans were allowed to be investigated or charged with war crimes. That's the kind of control the Allies had. German jurisdiction and search for truth was made impossible. Think about that. That we know that. They were not able to look to see what actually happened. Only the victors were to sit in judgment and to write history. The prosecution of war crimes in any other country was promptly prohibited. Not only were alleged deeds of Germans prosecuted in the most brutal manner, without consideration for any international legal principle, but it was explicitly ordered to lift the statute of limitations for so-called German war crimes or genocide. The Germans, thus being marked as outlaws as a result, can now have revenge taken on them until doomsday. This way, insidious partisans became national heroes. Honorable German officers who defended themselves against these scoundrels were called war criminals. So true. The present government of the German Federal Republic has ordered a 14-volume documentation concerning crimes committed on German prisoners of war and civilians not to be published, but to be pulped. Yeah, this was back then, you know. The National Socialists kept records, and then some people put them all together, and they came up, obviously, with a 14-volume documentation about crimes against Germans, the prisoners of war and the civilians. And what did their government do? It not only refused, ordered that it not be published, but it ordered it to be pulped so that nobody would ever be able to see it. Golda Meir, as Prime Minister of Israel, made it known in unmistakable terms that, quote, completely normal relations between Germany and Israel, unquote, would never exist. How can a past be left alone, which is stirred up anew daily to be used against our people? All schools continue to spread the lies about atrocities in concentration camps. There is, for instance, at this very moment, an exhibition being shown in Wiesbaden under the patronage of the Prime Minister of Hesse, which is titled Concentration Camp Sachsenhausen, where all the long-disproved propaganda lies are brought up again. As class after class is being channeled through the exhibition, the horrified children read that a gas chamber was built in Sachsenhausen in 1943, although it has been proved long since that there have never existed any gas chambers on German territory. It causes one to shudder when you read, quote, day and night, the Swedish smell of burnt human flesh was hanging over the camp, unquote. Such statements are being made in spite of the fact that the International Red Cross regularly inspected the concentration camps up to March 1945 and never reported on any gassing or cremating facilities or the Swedish smell. It is further maintained that every SS man in Sachsenhausen had the right to beat up and even kill a prisoner during roll call. That's the typical stuff that they say. And they were teaching these German children that at the time. Of course, cruelty occurred occasionally, but almost entirely between inmates themselves, or were committed by auxiliary guards, the so-called capos. If any SS man or any other German official committed any crime against prisoners or touched their property, he was immediately court-martialed. Now, Manfred Roeder was a military judge, and during that time, so he heard all these cases. He knew what was going on. He was privy to all of this. And he's not a liar. So he's saying that, you know, SS men and German officials could not hurt prisoners. They couldn't even touch their property. So I suppose if they had, they moved from one place to another, they said, say, gather up your property, you know, and they had to carry it themselves. Well, unless they put it in some kind of conveyance, if they're going far enough. But, you know, that was, people say, oh, look, they had to drag all this stuff around themselves, these poor old, you know, prisoners. Well, that was because they weren't, the Germans in the SS weren't supposed to touch any of their stuff. Their property was, it was really, it would amaze most of us to understand how well their property was taken care of. But anyway, what possible interests could Prime Minister, he asks, could Prime Minister Oswald of Hesse have in spreading such lies about Germany? He's the one who's sponsoring this exhibition in his state. Well, that's a good question, isn't it? We'll find out. Our entire school youth, he writes, is being poisoned with these lies about their fathers to deepen the hatred between generations evermore. But this is the recipe of the world conspirators to destroy a people. Well, he knew. He calls them the world conspirators. Whom does he mean? Well, we have to ask, who wants to destroy the German people? It wasn't only the Jews that wanted to destroy the German people. And we who know better, he says, should we keep silent? One who then still wants to tell us that this is a Christian thing to do, that is to keep silent, is in my eyes nothing but a worthless coward and scoundrel. The Minister of Education in Hesse has commissioned the Jewess Hannah Vogt to write a book about Germany's past entitled Guilt or Destiny, which already had its 11th printing and is distributed to all high school graduates. A Jewess will hardly be qualified to judge Germany's past objectively. This book turned out to be an absolute masterpiece of historical smear and hate propaganda in a scientific cloak, and can be put on a par with the works of the Comintern agent Willy Münzenberg, the unsurpassed, some of you may be familiar with this person, the unsurpassed master of anti-German agitation and lie propaganda, who would shout to his collaborators when they wrote an article against Germany. And now, you know, as it says here, he was a Comintern agent. He was in the employ. He was a German, but he was working for the Soviets, the Soviet communists. And so this sounds exactly like the way they do things. He would shout to his collaborators who were writing these articles and so on, too weak, too objective, knock them on the head, make the world stand aghast with horror, make them the stench of the world. All men must curse them and shudder with horror. Of course, he was talking about the German National Socialists, especially, when he said that, and that is the way the Soviet propaganda is. It's just really overkill. It's exaggerated beyond belief. And that's why the first stuff that came out was all from them. It was just crazy stuff, you know, which, later it had to be dropped. But they also, though, came up with the 6 million, which is having a hard time continuing. Anyway, continuing with this introduction. There is not one authentic document in existence which places the overall losses of the Jewish population during the last war higher than 200,000. That's what he says. Authentic document. During one single night in Dresden, and it was Christofferson, lived through the Dresden bombing. He lived through it. He said it had to be a miracle. He didn't know how, but he did. But now Reuters is referring to it and saying, during one single night in Dresden, more defenseless innocent Germans perished. Children, women, old people, and especially wounded men than Jews have died in all the concentration camps in the years of the National Socialist regime. And in these Jewish total losses, even natural deaths are included. Thus, the losses taken as a percentage and absolutely are much below those of any other power taking part in the war, keeping in mind that the Jewish world organizations had already in 1933 declared a holy war on Germany to be fought to the death. Well, what we have to remember when we think about how important Holocaust revisionism is that we know it's clear that Jews perpetrated the death of many millions of white Europeans, and then have claimed with this holocaust that they themselves were the biggest losers. They were the victims of all of this that they helped to create and were really essential in creating. Roeder goes on, Rader goes on, at that time, not a single hair on a Jew's head had been touched. Yet the world resounds with the clamor for the dead Jews. But no outrage is voiced about Dresden and the genuine figure of 6 million murdered East Germans. No voice is raised about the millions of murdered German and European war prisoners who had fought on the German side. He's saying German and European, other Europeans who were taken prisoner who had fought on the German side. No plaque tells us of the 105,000 Frenchmen who were murdered because they were pro-German. They were probably murdered by the French resistance members who are made into heroes, and they were nothing but they were murderers. They were horrible. But going on, no days of remembrance are held for the Dutch, Danes, Belgians, Norwegians, Romanians, Russians, Cossacks, Ukrainians, who were slaughtered in a most bestial manner for having worked or fought on the German side. Of course, the German side has been totally criminalized. I'm saying, you know, after the war at Nuremberg, they just managed to totally criminalize the German side. You couldn't be on the German side without having committed a crime of some kind. So it was actually removed from actually being a side. It was just a crime. He goes on, they wanted these different Europeans. They wanted to save Europe from Bolshevism, or in some cases, they thought that German control was probably considered to be the lesser evil. Yes, that was it in many cases. They may not have been in love with Hitler or National Socialism, but they knew it was better than Bolshevism. And they joined the German side. An employee of the present German Postal Service can be dismissed. Again, we're in the late 60s here, early 70s in 1970. Can be dismissed on the spot if he denies that Jews were gassed. This strange concept of justice was supported by a court in Hesse, which agreed that no employer needs to tolerate such utterances against Jews, which cannot be surpassed in their offensiveness. Every scoundrel, though, may freely boast today that he has committed sabotage and treason against Germany. That's true. That's true. They're heroes. If they were committing sabotage and treason during the time of the National Socialist reign. One of the concerned readers asked me if I were not perhaps falling victim to a new kind of anti-Semitism. On the contrary, I like to see the Jews being treated the same as everybody else and not enjoy special privileges. These privileges and the lies spread by certain Jewish world domination cliques are the cause of a new anti-Semitism. Mr. Wiesenthal promotes more anti-Semitism than I do. Every decent Jew will welcome our search for truth and therefore agree with this brochure. If you, whatever decent Jews you can find. And there were some. I think there were more then than there are now. By publishing this sensational report by Christofferson, we do not stir up nationalism or hatred, but merely serve the truth. And only the truth will make us and others free. Only injustice, which was really committed can be made good or forgiven. Invented atrocity stories will create new hatred and sow seeds of discontent without fail. We are not so much interested here in running up and down the scale of losses and crimes, but first of all, we are concerned, oh boy, I better hurry up. We are concerned about the spiritual recovery of our people. We have been accused of the worst crimes in the history of mankind, namely to have willingly started a global war, to have murdered millions of innocent people, and if we had the time and opportunity, we would have eliminated also the rest of all subjugated people. That's the charge. But he says that Hitler had no intention to kill Jews, and he says that there are no gas chambers. But what I want to get to is what the problem of the Germans, yeah, I thought I was further along than I am here. It is, he says, why are we Germans so in love with the fairy tale of the 6 million gas Jews? I can speak here from experience because I myself believed in it at one time. We Germans like brooding about a problem. We are God-fearing by nature. Therefore, we have had a profound religious explanation for the immeasurable. We have to have a profound religious explanation for the immeasurable misery of our people that we've been plunged into. To merely accept the explanation that others were stronger and more reckless is insufficient for the German soul. We believe that nobody has to suffer such misery without a reasonable cause. It's like the problem of Job. He brings up the problem of Job, saying that Job did not believe that he was guilty, even though his friends told him what he was suffering was a punishment from God. And he says the myth of 6 million innocent murdered people actually satisfied the demand for a metaphysical explanation. It was therefore eagerly accepted by the Germans. Well, I'm going to try to continue this. Back, ladies and gentlemen, be back in 5 minutes. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And before my second hour guest calls in, or maybe or comes on, or maybe while he does, I'm going to try to finish this. I'm really sorry that I kind of lost track of that this good part was at the end here, and I still had it to do, and I wasn't watching the time well enough. So I was talking about how our Manfred Roeder was writing about how the Jews, how the Germans are a God-fearing people, and they needed an explanation for this catastrophe that they went through, what they call the catastrophe of 1945, which was, it went on for several years, you know, and then afterwards it got even worse. So it was so terrible. And they didn't know that they had done anything wrong. And so he brings up the, he says, we Germans, no, I already did that part. He brings up the story of Job. And then he says Job wrestles with his re-educators and gives them the proper answer. He says, this is what Job said, and this is what the Germans should say. This affliction comes upon me for no understandable reason. I don't know why. It is beyond me, but I have not sinned against God. I have not gone astray from the right path. I want to reason with him. I have kept the faith. One day he will justify me in public. And Roeder says, this is the voice of a righteous man. Isn't that the way we ought to speak? We do away with the two great lies on which this whole post-war development rests. He says, there is no chosen people, Israel, who could claim to be identical with the Jews. And there is certainly no condemned criminal German people. We shall fight uncompromisingly against anyone who upholds one of these lies or versions thereof and thereby drives our people deeper into misery. It says the time has come to stand up and be counted, to bring about a change of fortune. We shall conquer fate because we are fulfilling God's commission. Therefore, I am so grateful to Thies Christofferson, who has set a shining example to our people with this courageous work. Anyway, he's saying, you know, that he does a good job here. I think I left some of it out, but of explaining in his view why the Germans cling to their guilt. He said, here's part of it. He says, seems to become all the more plausible and based on the Bible. We did not murder just any people, but we murdered the chosen people. As one of the readers wrote to me in these words, yes, we have assaulted the apple of God's eye. What a wonderful explanation. Now we know why. We have got something to suffer for, and through subservience to all Jews and by paying colossal sums of money, we can regain at least part of God's favor, or as repentant sinners look forward to forgiveness. That is the reason why the German clings to the murdered Jews as though it meant the salvation of his soul. Without this explanation, our terrible downfall would have had no higher meaning and be all the harder to bear. So that I think is helps us to understand that we need to help the German people get over this, and we have to undo the Holocaust in order to do it. And you know, all of this comes together for me very, very well and very clearly. So now, in the second hour, ladies and gentlemen, I'm waiting for Hanning Scott to come on. We had agreed that he would, so he should be listening, and he can certainly come on right now. And we're going to talk about some other subject, which I will start as soon as he comes on. I wonder where he is. I'm going to go to my Skype page and see if he's even got his Skype turned on. Now, where am I going to find him? I better go to contacts. It's been a while. No, he doesn't have his Skype turned on. I wonder why. I wonder why he doesn't. He knew it was 10 o'clock his time. So he's very slow about things like this. I don't know why. I don't know what's going on with him. Well, Hattie, if you're listening, turn on your Skype and call in. So I'll have to start this on my own. I hope he'll call in, because I was kind of depending on him quite a bit. And then I hurried through my other stuff. What if he fell asleep or something? Anything could happen. Let's see. How am I going to start this? Okay. Well, tonight, there's been a lot of, you know, I've come in contact with a lot of it. I suppose a lot of people haven't, but I've come in contact with a lot of talk and conversation and back and forth and comment boards about Veronica Kuznyar Clark. And there is a lot about her, her book, Black Nazis, that's been talked about. And in fact, tonight, she was on with Deanna Spingola from 7 to 9 Central. So that program's just got over with. And some of you might have been listening to it. And I listened to the first part of it, most of the first hour. Didn't get too much out of it. But, you know, my new thing about, it's not my new thing, it's my old thing, but wanting to get the truth about Hitler, National Socialism in Germany, and I think that a lot of people are not only putting out the truth, not putting out the truth, but are muddying the waters terribly. But they sound good. They can sound good. And Veronica Clark and her books that she's putting out is part of that, a big part of that. And I have a real complaint about what she's doing. And so I don't mind talking about it. I think it needs to be talked about. I'm going to, here he comes. All right, here's Mr. Hadding.
Hello.
Hi, Hadding.
Is my sound level okay?
Sound good to me.
Okay, good. I have a different
mic. We'll let the listeners send a message or something if they think it's not loud enough. But I've got my earphones on, you know, and so you sound perfectly all right. Yeah.
Yeah, I just listened to that fiasco with Deanna Spingola and...
Spingola. Okay, yeah, I'll let you go ahead. Tell us what's
her name again? Veronica Kuznyar Clark, something like that.
Yes.
It was like listening to an hour of World War II propaganda almost, I swear. Well, you know what? I'd like one thing I want to work into this is a presentation of what the National Socialist German Workers' Party's position on race actually was, because she starts off from the premise that they were some kind of extreme. Well, basically, she starts off from the premise that the World War II propaganda was all true, right? And she's going to say, wow, the World War II propaganda wasn't 100% true. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Sure, no kidding.
Yeah, like she's telling us something, you know. That's what I feel about the whole thing with her, is that nothing she's saying is new. Nothing is teaching us anything unless you're totally ignorant and a part of the mainstream. That's about it. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. I have this chapter. This is like an instruction outline for new members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Mm-hmm. It's from a book called Politische Fibel, which is a political outline of National Socialism by a man named Hans-Jürg Mennel. This was for indoctrinating new members of the National Socialist Party. Section on race. This is chapter one.
Okay, when was this written or so? You know,
The first edition, I believe, was 1933. I translated the 1940 edition.
Okay. Right?
Okay. And it says at the top, only those party members who possess a special license from the Office of Racial Policy of the NSDAP may teach about specific questions of racial science and genetics. Okay, continuing. Race is a group of people with the same physical and mental hereditary traits. Race is invariable, enduring. Every human being, like every other living creature, inherits its own traits of body, mind, and character. The folk varies precisely in accord with its racial composition. The character of a folk results from its racial composition. Mm-hmm. The German folk consists of several races. Nordic, Eastern, which is, it says in parentheses, Alpine. So when you see Ostisch, that's the same as Alpine.
Oh, Dinaric. I thought Alpine was like the Swiss or something.
Well, Alpine is a certain racial type. They're kind of they're like round skulls. Most
right,
Slavs.
Right. The rounder headed ones.
Dinaric, East Baltic, Falian, that's my type, and Western, which it says is also Mediterranean. See Günther, Brief Racial Study of the German Folk.
Let me just say here, let me throw this in here because it fits. And then I promise I won't interrupt again. But, you know, what you're reading here from this this book for our new members, this is exactly, and you say it was in 1933, and then yours, the one you're translating, was updated in 1940 or something, or published then. And you know, in her book Hitler and Himmler, where she in her translation, it's not hers, it's Will Hike's translation of Hitler's Platterhof speech, that she makes the whole thing, her whole thing about that goes around this one paragraph in that speech, where Hitler talks about how race and people are not the same, that the people are made up of several races, and he mentions these very races. And exactly. She takes this, you know, now and says, oh, this is groundbreaking. This was something he said in 1944, and it was new to him, and nobody had ever heard about it. She makes all this. And, you know, I know, I've already figured this out, you see, that I already looked into this. And she's just totally wrong. She's trying to base some kind of great discoveries of hers on nothing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he was simply restating the established position.
That's right. And he even said, when he was saying that, I have talked about this before. And she just ignored that.
Yeah.
Part of it. Okay.
Continuing, the concepts, Germanic, Romance, Slavic, etc., delineate not separate races, but language and folk groups, which certainly also exhibit a distinctive racial imprint.
Mm-hmm.
Most Slavs, of course, being Alpine. In Germany, the Nordic race preponderates. Tall, thin, long-headed, small-faced, blonde, blue-eyed, prudent, creative, energetic, truthful, brave, leader-like, cool, reserved, often gruff, propensity for solitude, for seclusion, and eccentricity. That's a generalization there. Of course, a lot of Nordics are not blonde.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this is a simplified version. The Nordic race is the binding component, the unifying element of our folk. It is the determining, guiding, and culture-creating power of the German nation. The exterior of a human being is not by itself a signifier of his race. A small, dark German, therefore, is not necessarily inferior or un-German. He could very well be a bearer of Nordic heritage. The races of which the German folk consists are all related to each other. Consequently, they have more that is in common than distinct. The German folk represents a unity. The particular races that comprise it produce the polymorphism and richness of the German essence. Nonetheless, without inhibiting the unity of our nation, a danger of the first order to the German folk could therefore result only through mixture with alien races. Germany is the mighty wedge which the Nordic race forms on the European mainland. It must maintain itself in the face of all neighboring peoples, which are racially entirely differently constituted. All Europe is menaced by alien races. In France, the Negro gains ever more acceptance. In the Rhineland, the black disgrace is supreme. The black occupation troops left behind many hundreds of bastards in the Rhineland. Every mixture with racial aliens, e.g. Jews, Negroes, Mongols, leads necessarily to the decline of the nation. In racial chaos, all great states and cultures have perished. For example, Greece and Rome. From this recognition result these demands: expulsion of the racial aliens and preservation of the purity of our race. Through the Nuremberg Laws, the Blood Protection Law and the Reich Citizenship Law of September 15th, 1935, mixture of the German folk with racially alien Jewry is therefore finally halted. The German folk must die if its typical and fundamental component, the Nordic race, dies out. This danger looms not just externally, but also internally. So there you go. It's all admitted right there.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, there was mixture. They had these races, but they did. There were certain races that they considered German and some of them not.
Mm-hmm. You mean some of the races within the German people they considered to be not German?
Yeah, Jews and Negroes.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, amongst the races that make up the German people, the real German people, because everybody's always known that Germans weren't all Nordics. You know, nobody ever expected that. I mean, anybody who's living in Germany or German people knew that they had quite a few types of people, but they were all considered German. And, of course, there was at one time more of a distinction between the north and the south, and Bavaria was, you know, very kind of jealous of its own independence and so on, and all this stuff. And Hitler did work hard to bring all this together and see, so everyone would see themselves as German, the German folk. And sure, there's differences, but there's still German. I mean, my mother is German. She has dark hair and brown eyes. You know, my father has had blonde, even a little bit of reddish, mostly though, blonde hair and blue eyes. And we three kids all had light hair and light eyes. Nobody took after my mother. But I think it's because in her family, she also had cousins and stuff who had blonde hair and blue eyes. So there was, you know, two strains in her family, but in my father's, they were all blonde and basically blue-eyed. My eyes are green. I mean, this is just, it's stupid. It's stupid to even say that people even believe that, because nobody ever believed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's saying, this is the perception that people have. Only the most outlandish propaganda type perception. So that's what she's fighting. So Veronica Clark is standing up against the most outlandish propaganda type ideas about Germans and about National Socialists and Nazis.
Toward the end of the interview, she was especially getting into some old saws of Allied propaganda, like making fun of the leadership of National Socialist Germany. Goering was fat, and Goebbels had a club foot. What kinds of supermen are these, right?
Yeah.
That was the old propaganda, right? Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. Goering was fat, but he was a war hero. You know, he'd been a flying ace of the First World War. And as for Goebbels, his club foot was not hereditary. He'd had an illness when he was a child that caused his club foot.
Yeah.
Himmler is strange looking, but he looks better if you take the little round glasses off him.
Himmler, yeah.
Yeah, Himmler.
Yeah, you know, I used to think Himmler was kind of weird, but I've gotten to like him quite a bit. And I think really highly of him. It's hard to say that in general. If you think about general company, general population listening to you, well, that Heinrich Himmler, he was really a good fellow. His reputation is so extreme.
Yeah, that thing that I read from the indoctrination outline there, that you get pretty much the same thing from Alfred Rosenberg's The Myth of the 20th Century. If you look in the index under race and then go to the page where it has that it refers to, you get pretty much the same thing.
Well, I have not criticized Veronica Clark openly until now. And I have been aware of her doing those shows with Deanna Spingola, and they're being very popular and people liking her a lot. And I've known her and what she was doing since 2000. I must have been in 2007, if it wasn't earlier than that, when she put up her very first website. And then I liked it. But then she put up, took that down after at least a year. It was up at least a year, I think. And then started another one. And then after that, she was constantly taking stuff down, putting things up, taking them down, and then blaming it on all these forces that were, destroying her. And I don't believe a word of that anymore. I think it's just her, because she's still doing the same thing. And she tries to blame it on people bothering her and trying to, now she's blaming it on white nationalists.
Yeah.
She's been doing that for quite a while. And so I've read all that stuff, and I think she's, I think she's not going to last in this National Socialist Movement or this anti-Nazi thing. She's written all these books, but she's got this interest now. She has shifted. I think at that time, when she started, being a Nazi was the most extreme thing, you know, that came up to her. I think she likes to be very extreme. Now she's an asexual, kind of a transvestite, or she likes transvestites. I'm not saying she is one.
She's weird as hell.
She is, really is. And she's gotten into all this, and now she's supposedly getting a continuing her schooling, getting a PhD, wanting to get it in psychology, particularly into sexual something. And she's asexual.
Yeah, probably sexual ambivalence, right? Because it's like with the racial ambivalence, right?
Yeah, there you go. It all fits. You know, she has to be on the extreme edge, and that's why she's doing all this. And I think now that she's found this sexuality, sexology, I think she's got a website. She's got that website that is, what's it called? spadeofaces.wordpress.com. I invite people to go to that. You know, I heard Deanna Spingola tonight, and boy, you know, you really taking it on yourself when you start, if you criticize Deanna Spingola, because everybody thinks she's just Miss Wonderful. But I wrote to her a few days ago. I sent her an email. We haven't been, you know, speaking together, but I sent it to her, and I sent her that link to that website of Veronica's. And I just asked the question, did you know? And she wrote back, and I was pleased that she wrote back, and she said, no, I didn't know. And then she said, thank you. But tonight on that radio program, she asked Veronica, do you have another website, you know, besides this Vera Icona? And Veronica said, now she knew she did, but she pretended like she didn't know. And then Veronica said, yes, I do, but it's a personal website. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Well, really, it does, but, you know, it tells all this stuff about her and shows all these transvestites that she thinks are such hot men and so on and all this stuff. And then Deanna said, oh, okay, all right, and just accepted it at that and didn't say, well, I've seen your website and it's kind of strange, but if you don't want to talk about it, we don't have to, or at least, you know, well, but to act like she didn't know when she did know. See, I find that kind of, I don't know. So it's spadeofaces.wordpress.com. And, then she's got links on there to one that's called, what is it? Asexual sexology, something like that. And that seems to be hers too. It looks exactly the same, and somebody's talking, and it seems to be her, and she's going to school and she's studying this, and she's really into it. So I think that's her next thing.
Yeah. Well, I want to point out something that makes all of her current rhetoric very strange. Stranger than it is. Are you aware of this statement attributed to her? It's on the Holocaust controversy. See, I didn't really pay much attention to her at all till the last few days, because I started posting on the Tila Tequila blog, and then she shows up on there just kind of really exploiting it to promote her work, her books, you know?
Books, yeah.
And she said some things that rubbed me the wrong way, and she took correction rather badly, like She insists on using the word Nazi. She makes excuses for that, even though it looks like cheap sensationalism. But are you aware of this statement that's attributed to her? I found it on the Holocaust controversy.
Yeah, blog. I've seen that myself.
She said that the Jews are a shit people, and if she were the president of the United States, she would have them all exterminated, something like that. Something to
oh,
that.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Oh, yeah.
I saw one that wasn't that quite that drastic. But she did, these things appear to have been back some 2009 or something like that.
This is 2007.
Well, that's when she first got into this stuff, unless it was even 2006. Because I don't, you know, have any of those old emails. I had some emails with her way back then, but I wouldn't have saved them. And she was saying things like that then, I guess, but she would never say that now. She won't talk about the Holocaust now, really.
Well, it's just the thing that puzzles me is, or the thing that seems paradoxical, is that she was saying stuff like that, which, mm-hmm. I mean, you would rarely hear a white nationalist, even a self-proclaimed white nationalist, say something like that. That's just the kind of thing you would hear from a beer-swilling skinhead, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly that stereotype is what she was, or appeared to be, or sounded like in 2007. But now, she's screaming about how those awful white nationalists are a bunch of psychos. Wait a minute, who's the psycho?
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, and she calls them tattoo. I read something just today in their white tattooed skin, and she skinheads and so on. She wants to treat everybody as trailer trash and so on. When she was acting that way then, she was being that way then, I guess.
Yeah, in 2007, mm-hmm. she says that she wouldn't have any problem with killing all the Jews. But now she's
well, she wasn't trying to write all these books. You know, another strange thing about her is that once she decided that, what I read somewhere, Hadding, and I probably got it here somewhere, is that when she was getting her master's degree and she was doing her thesis on Hitler and she got into this black Nazi thing, and so she did it on that. And then when she found out, and she took out all kinds of student loans up to astronomical numbers, according to her. And when she found out that her work was not going to be accepted in the mainstream universities and their history departments, and the historians didn't accept what she was doing. Well, what would you expect?
Yeah.
You know, is she just retarded in some way, or is she just saying these things for effect, or what? So then she says that she realized she didn't have a career there, so she wasn't going to pay back her loan because she could never get it paid back in her whole life, since she was not able to earn any money from all the education she had. So now she decided she was going to write books, and then she got into publishing. I guess she didn't publish her own right at the beginning. She started with the Black Nazis, her master's thesis, and then she's gone crazy with all these books that she's publishing. And now she's promoting that, see. So she wouldn't be saying and be now she doesn't want white nationalists to be, she doesn't want to be associated with any of that. It's all about her success and her career path, you know.
Yeah, she does not seem to be fact-oriented. She seems to be sensation-oriented. She's going to say things that are sensational that'll make people pay attention to her. There are a number of people who've gravitated to this milieu who act that way, who show that pattern. And it's unfortunate because these people who are reckless and keep dishing out all this stuff that's provocative end up attracting a lot more attention than other people who are a little more careful.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yes, right. Exactly. Go ahead.
I want to point out, she goes from, in 2007, she goes from talking about how she'd be very happy to kill off all the Jews to 2 years later, according to what she says now, she becomes a paid supporter of the SPLC.
Yeah.
All right, that's what she says now. And she mentioned that to Diana Spingola. She said she'd been a paid supporter of the SPLC since 2009. Now, where I saw that statement from her originally, it was on one of these blogs.
Well, she also wrote about that on her comment, you know, on a couple of programs of mine about these subjects. She came on to the White Network comment board for my programs, and actually I was happy that she did, because I was able to answer a lot, you know, ask her a lot of questions that I had been seeing this stuff about her and reading these things, and I didn't know if it was really her or not, or if somebody was impersonating her, you know, because they were so kind of shocking. And so she answered most everything eventually. So we had quite a lot of back and forth there. And I found out things I was quite amazed at, like this, her transvestite friends and so on. Just really. And she's a paleo-liberal. She still says it on her blog. She's a paleo-liberal. Some people say that it's like the neoconservatives. The neoconservatives are paleo-liberals.
I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean. Paleo-liberal, if you're talking about 18th century liberal, that means the free market kind of stuff, which is completely outdated, nothing to do with National Socialism. But anyway.
Really?
It was September of this year that she posted at least one forum that she had been a supporter of the SPLC since 2009. Now, she said this by way of distancing herself from white nationalism. In other words, what she was saying was she really supported the SPLC. That's what she was conveying.
Well, she admitted it on the program tonight. I heard her.
But, yeah, she said that, but Deanna Spingola...
I know! Just accepted it.
She put a spin on it. It's like, oh, you just subscribed to the SPLC so that you can get their information and find out what they're saying.
And Deanna is protecting her for some reason instead of trying to get at who this Veronica Clark really is. And when Veronica Clark told her that she did say that about the SPLC, Deanna had not known that. But right away, because Veronica says yes, she thinks it's okay. And she makes it out to be okay. Oh, I see. All right. You know, and then she start, as you're saying, spins it into something that is not what it was. But this is what makes this whole thing so crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was saying a lot of stuff that was really horrendous. She said Hans F. K. Gunther was the father of Nordicism. That's not true. There's an American that wrote on Nordicism before Gunther. But anyway, she goes from that to saying, to quoting Gunther, that there was some Negro ancestry in Germany. I don't know exactly.
She makes things up. She makes things up. I used to think she had. I even knew when in all those programs she was doing with Deanna Spingola that people thought she was such a great scholar. I realized that she was saying things that weren't right, but you couldn't call in then. You were not allowed to call in because Veronica was afraid of callers. So you couldn't say anything about it. And then after it was over, I thought, oh, forget it, you know. But she would also use books, and she took everything out of a book. In all her programs, she's got one or maybe more, but basically one book, and she's telling what this author has said and done and done, and it's all coming out of there, you know. And some of these books she was using were from these real sleazy writers, you know, the kind of Hitler was a Jew type writers and so on. And she was saying, well, I like to see both sides of the issue and all. Just ignorant. I mean, she is not a scholar. And in her, when she talks about the black Nazi stuff, she has no real evidence for it.
After you finish
what you want to say, let's get into that black Nazi business.
Well, I couldn't really discuss, you know, what Gunther said about Negro ancestry in Germany, because I haven't read Gunther. But we know that she's distorted other things, like Hitler's statement, which does not mean at all what she's making it mean.
Right.
It's just a restatement of traditional National Socialist racial policy. But then she goes on to use this thing that was published in, I think, the Daily Mail a couple of years ago. This guy, Mulders, the Belgian, that did the research on Adolf Hitler to find out if Jean Loret, the Frenchman, was really Hitler's illegitimate son. In 2008, Mulders published the fact that Jean Loret was not Adolf Hitler's son. However, accidentally, Mulders had established that the old story about Hitler's father being a Jew was not true, because Hitler had the same Y chromosome as all the other Hitlers, Hitlers, and Hutlers in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was established that this story about Hitler was a Jew was not true, or a part Jew, right? Well, 2 years later, exactly 2 years later, to the day, you get a story saying, genetic finding shows Hitler had probably Negro or Jewish ancestry, because something like 18% of Jews also have that Y chromosome, and because on the northern fringe of Africa, there are a lot of people that have that Y chromosome.
Right.
Now,
this is how things get so distorted.
It's propaganda, because they're telling a half-truth and running with the half that they presented. Because what they don't say is that this Y chromosome is also very, very prevalent on the coast of the Adriatic Sea in Europe. Extremely. It's like something near 50%. Which is not far from Austria. And also, they don't say that the people who brought that chromosome into Africa, as you can tell from the geographic distribution, were Berbers, who originally were a blonde and blue-eyed people. The fact that you find a Y chromosome in Europe that's also carried by the ancestors of Berbers does not mean that Negroes invaded Europe. It means that white people went into Africa and brought their Y chromosome with them, because you cannot mix, say, 10% Negro ancestry into the German nation without it being really goddamned obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I don't understand people who are fooled by this kind of thing. Having grown up in the South, you know, I know that a little bit of Negro ancestry goes a long way, you put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, then she was talking about these this Negro family, her latest book. I heard that, her latest book, and it's about this Negro in Germany, and how he was very anti-Nazi, but she's
still wrote a book about it.
Yeah, and then he had some sisters or something. Well, they looked just pure white. You couldn't tell him. They were pure white. Well, I wonder what she's talking about there. You know, does she have pictures in her book? And, you know, what was the, how did they become pure white from being Negro? I don't know. Did you follow that?
Well, this Sabak al-Sher, apparently there was a German emperor like in the 1830s or something like that, that received I guess he was a slave from somebody in Egypt. Yeah, but the slave, you know, probably wasn't a full-blooded Negro in the first place. If he was in Egypt, he was probably Sudanese or something. They get mixed with Arab and Berber and Negro in North Africa. And he had descendants. He had a son, that Günther Elscher or something, that, you know, there's a picture of him in a Prussian, uniform, wearing the Pickelhaub, you know, the helmet with the spike on top. And he was pretty ugly. And, beyond that, I don't know much about them. But you see what she's doing. She's picking out oddities.
Right. Exactly. Well put. They are all oddities. They're not, they're not the usual run-of-the-mill thing that goes on there. Yeah.
Another thing about this, I looked into this question. Well, first of all, let's say plainly, there were no black Nazis. There were no black members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. None. It was not open to non-Aryan membership. Mm-hmm. So her insinuation that this Negro in the picture from Ken magazine was with the NSDAPAO is false. It cannot be true. Because the standards for membership in the NSDAPAO were exactly the same as the membership in the NSDAP.
Right.
But what there were is there were some half Negroes in the Wehrmacht.
Mm-hmm.
In the Wehrmacht. I looked into that a little bit. Now, their policy was that they would take half Jews until 1940. After that, they would only take quarter Jews. That was their official policy. And
you know, when you're talking about the Wehrmacht, you're talking about people who are going to be on the battlefield. And you're not all that particular. If people want to fight and you need soldiers, I'll let them do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you see, the Wehrmacht was just the German army.
Yeah.
It was not a political organization. It was just the National Army. The SS was somewhat political, but not right. The Wehrmacht. But anyway, their policy was they would not allow full Jews into the Wehrmacht. They would allow people that had some Jewish ancestry. But you get people saying constantly, oh, there were all these Jews in the Wehrmacht. Yeah. No, they were not Jews. They were Mischlings. Mm-hmm. People who were, after 1940, a quarter Jew was the standard. Not more than a quarter Jew could be in the Wehrmacht. They tightened the standard in 1940. But there were also some half-Negroes that got into the Wehrmacht. Their standard was that they couldn't get into the Wehrmacht, but at least a couple of them got in anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And you know this mulatto that became the editor of Ebony magazine, Hans-Jürgen Massaquoi.
Oh, is he the editor of Ebony magazine?
He was. He was a Rhineland bastard. He was half-Negro. And he tried to join the Wehrmacht, but he was turned down.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of other examples. There was one, Hans Hauck.
Yeah.
Was another Rhineland bastard.
He got in, right?
He was the son of a French-Algerian soldier stationed in the Rhineland. Right. And he applied. He also was turned down. But then he tried to kill himself.
Right.
After he tried to kill himself.
I really find it strange that they would feel sorry for him and let him in after that, but maybe somebody knew him and did.
After he tried to kill himself, they let him into the Wehrmacht. And there was another example of a black that was half Cameroonian and got into the Wehrmacht. He was not a Rhineland bastard. But see, the thing is, what you see there is there was the policy, and then there was the possibility of making exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this relates to a fundamental National Socialist idea, which is the idea of not having a system set up with strict regulations that's supposed to run itself. You rely on having people in positions of authority who can make decisions, who can make exceptions.
Mm-hmm. I think Hitler referred to that a lot in that Platterhoff speech. You know, I'm going to have to talk about that more someday. But he referred to that kind of thinking and that officers needed to be able to make these kind of decisions. Not, he didn't say racial decisions, but you know, they needed, there were a lot of decisions that had to be made. It wasn't all just go by the book.
Well, that principle had a lot of different manifestations. It also manifested in the fact that the unit commanders in the military had more autonomy than, you know, in many armed forces. And that's, the German armed forces are still like that today.
Well, we're going to run out of time. I really wish this was a program that could just extend itself like some people's do. But what can we say about this black Nazi thing? Why? Or here's the question I'd like us to discuss a little bit. What is Veronica Clark's point in all of this besides coming up with what she can convince people of is new and you know, spectacular information and write these books, put out these books with these fancy covers that, you know, and hope to make a living. You know, she's out to make money for one thing, but, you know, what kind of political agenda is she trying to get across? It's not the one that I heard her say on that program, on the program tonight. It's not that. It's something, she's got something more subversive going on. It might not seem subversive to her, but it is very much anti-racial thinking, and she wants to get rid of the idea that the Germans and that the National Socialists were all that racial, and they are quite happy with having all these other people. And she'll talk about all these other races that were in Germany or were fighting in the war and so on, when they are mostly European nationalities, or you could call them races, I guess, but they weren't non-white. Just a few, you know, the non-whites were the exceptional ones, you know. But she'll say 11 million, you know, oh, 11 million non-German so personnel and workers were helping the Reich. You know, things like that.
See, she's playing a bit of a rhetorical shell game when she says things like that, because she's confounding non-German with non-white.
Yes, she is.
And if you look at the actual numbers, I looked at some of them. The Freies Arabian Legion, the Free Arabia Legion, was pretty big. It had, according to German Wikipedia, more than 20,000 volunteers in the Free Arabia Legion. That's pretty big for one of these units. But, you know, even compare that to the casualties that Germany suffered in World War II. I think it was 7 million men that they lost. 20,000 volunteers is not a huge number.
No, it's not.
It's very small. It's an interesting image to see, you know, say an Indian, you know, in a German military unit, but there were only 2,600 of those. 2,600.
Yeah, 2,600. I mean, that's nothing.
It is. It's an historical oddity.
Yeah.
And her claim that the German armed forces in World War II were the most racially or ethnically diverse. As far as racially, I'm sorry, but the non-whites that the Germans mobilized were mostly prisoners of war. The British Empire had many more races at its disposal to mobilize,
yes,
as troops than Germany had. Certainly in terms of total percentage of non-whites, the American armed forces with all the Negroes, certainly had more than 20,000 Negroes in the U.S. Army, probably.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. She wants to say that, the Germans have this reputation for being so racist, but they weren't. Well, they didn't. They were. You know, I don't really want that to be so.
Well, this
changed.
Is the thing. This is the thing. The Nuremberg law. You have to start with a caricature in order to say, well, that caricature is not true. Okay, but if you're starting with that caricature, you're really starting from a really stupid starting point. The Nuremberg laws for preservation of the German nation were never repealed. And Hitler's last message to the German people was, abide by the racial law. That was his political testament,
a
couple of pages that he dictated. Mm-hmm. I have a summary here of why I think Veronica Clark's work is destructive. This is probably going to ring a bell with you. First, it is destructive to historical revisionism insofar as it damages the credibility of revisionism. She is not doing research so much as recycling the research of others as fodder for her cheap rhetoric, which is often very easily refuted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Second, she is attacking the very principle of race. she puts National Socialist Germany into a competition with the rest of the world for the title of most racially inclusive. Which is a competition that Germany actually would not win.
Right.
In doing this, she endorses racial diversity as a value. She also maintains that National Socialist Germany as a racial state was ultimately untenable, which is something that Jews have been trying to insinuate for many decades now.
Absolutely.
They've been saying, oh, you see, there were these economically necessary Jews. Germany couldn't get along without the Jews. Right? That's what she's saying. Only she's including more than Jews. She's including Negroes and all kinds of other people.
Yeah, she loves to point out how many Jews were in the Hitler's army, Hitler's armed forces, you know. And she exaggerates, of course, so we know she uses Milch, in, you know, for one of the field marshals. But,
right.
But you know, why is she so anxious to talk about how many? Because she thinks that she's doing a service, or she wants people to think she's doing a service. By undermining the racist accusations against Nazis. Yeah.
Here's another thing. Did you see this? She says, furthermore, I do not deny the Holocaust. The number of dead is irrelevant. If the Jewish people wish to call their suffering a Holocaust, then they are entitled to do so as much as any other people that has suffered calculated mass murder, discrimination, upheaval, etc. That's on
information. Oh, man, when did she say that?
That's on Information Underground blog. She posted that on the 13th of September, 2013.
September 2013. See, it is in recent times that she's just really turned around. And that's why she won't talk about Holocaust anymore, because she doesn't want to. Say the same things she used to say about it. She doesn't not only want to be a Holocaust denier, she doesn't even want to be a Holocaust revisionist, does she?
She's going along with Mark
Weber there.
Yeah, exactly. She's weasel worded that statement pretty much the same way Mark Weber does. She's avoided actually saying there were no gas chambers, there was no Holocaust. She's saying if they want to call whatever it was a Holocaust, that's okay with me.
Oh, great. Well, you know, there's one thing I need to say before we close, because I put it in my mailer that, you know, what's behind this desire for a non-German Hitler. And this is one of my things. Not everybody would agree with me on this, I'm sure. But it seems to me that, you know, when Hitler gets real popular and everybody wants to kind of get a piece of him or wrap themselves in him, they want to take away his Germanness and make him into some kind of a man of the world, or some kind of a, you know, someone, a hero for everyone. And I suppose a lot of people think that's good, and I should like that, but I don't like it, because he was 100% German, and everything he did was for the German people, and he had goodwill for all other people. But, you know, I don't like this move to kind of take him out of Germany and put him into some kind of a globalist, you know, saint or something.
You don't prefer the Hitler of the rap videos?
No. Right. Thank you. Yeah, that's a problem that I'm having with it. It's not historical. It's just all this, it's all this mushy internet stuff. What would you call it? I mean, it's just all this misinformation crap that goes on, where people are having a great time, like at Tequila's blog. Now, I'm real happy that she's come out and said all these things. I'm real happy about it, but now she's become some kind of a, you know, fount of wisdom or some kind of a
saint.
Well,
see, that's a mistake.
Herself.
It's okay it's okay that she says some stuff, since she's got a platform and some attention. She's going to say some things that people are afraid to say. That's a good thing, but I don't want, you know, I don't like, you know, for example, I saw some people on that fascist blog saying, well, they were treating her like she was some kind of, you know, venerable figure or something.
Right.
No, that's wrong. Don't do that. She's just somebody that happened to have the limelight, and she said a few good things. It doesn't mean that you can rely on her to be a font of wisdom.
Right. Right. So, I mean, I like her just fine, although she is a stripper and all that stuff. But, I mean, I have nothing against her, but I don't, but people will jump on things like this, and it just shows the idiocy. But it's always been, I guess, that the people who don't think and just like to get turned on by whatever is the latest exciting thing outnumber the thinkers, and they're always going to be there, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, this thing with her saying that, she wanted to, she would like to kill all the Jews. That was like a warning sign from the start that this woman was not reliable, because that was not a realistic statement. She's just speaking for effect. And she's still, I think, speaking for effect.
Well, I hope that she gets into her sexology and forgets about it. I'm really looking forward to the fact that she will leave this behind after her books don't sell as well as she would like them. What's your last?
And I hope that the awful white nationalists will leave her alone because she's so persecuted.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing this program tonight, but I'm more than happy to leave her alone. If she would leave us alone, if she would leave Nazism alone, if she'd leave Hitler alone, I'd leave her alone.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, she's kind of forcing people to discuss her and then saying, it's so terrible.
Yeah, she's always done that. She's always, and even when she got disconnected before the show, that's another trick she pulls. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Thank you, Hanning, for coming on. I enjoyed this very much.
All right.
And we'll do it again sometime. Good night, everyone. And Happy New Year.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.